Excellent. So, when I was talking this morning about the nature of insight and how it arises, and that we don't do insight meditation and then samatha meditation or samatha and then insight. For those of you who know your suttas, there is one place which many people often quote, the four ways where people become enlightened, as explained by Ananda, if I'm not mistaken, just quoting the Buddha's teachings. And he was saying that some people do samatha first and then vipassana, some people do vipassana first and then samatha, and some people do samatha and vipassana together. Well, the last one is the one which is most interesting to people because it's not so clear. Or that somehow or other, I understand this as you get some inspiration, but in each one of these four, the path becomes clear. And then you make much of that path to eventually become fully enlightened. And my understanding of that sutta is each one of those four different ways is the ways to become a soul one, to get the pala, the stream winning, either of those four, any of those four ways. But once you become a soul one, then it's all the same path, which is you make much of the path, you develop it, and that path is always the eightfold path, nothing else. But there is no just samatha vipassana, vipassana samatha, samatha vipassana, they all go together. And the reality is you do some calm, you calm, make the mind peaceful, and that serves the purpose, as I've been mentioning, of giving energy to your mindfulness. Your mindfulness increases in its power and the hindrances get less of an obstacle for you. So by doing samatha, you are suppressing the hindrances and increasing the mindfulness, which is why insight can happen. And when you get insight, it also suppresses the obstacles so that you get calmer and more peaceful. The two will always work together, in my understanding. And you do a little bit of samatha, and then you get insight. The insight helps the samatha helps the insight. This is not just that third option of samatha and vipassana working together. They always go together. And the simile which convinced me was again from Ajahn Chah. He never had much opportunity to actually to give visual aids, no TVs. So he would use whatever was at his disposal. And when he was asked the question, the difference between samatha and vipassana, he would always hold up his hand and he would ask or tell all the people looking, whether it was monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, say, now you can see the front of my hand, you cannot see the back. Now you can see the back and you cannot see the front. Even though you can only see the back of my hand, the front is right behind. And now you can see the front of my hand, the back is right behind. And he called, this is samatha, this is vipassana. Samatha may be leading, but vipassana is right behind. Vipassana might be leading, but right behind that is vipassana. They all tend to go together. And you cannot separate the front of a hand from the back of a hand. And Ajahn Chah would say, you cannot separate samatha from vipassana, they always go together. And you can tell how deep your samatha is by how much insight comes up, how you more understand the path and the nature of the Dhamma. The more calm you get, the more obvious the Dhamma is. And the same, the more insight which you get, the more calm you become. So, please be very careful with your mobile phones, because if they go off during a Dhamma talk, It's bad karma. Not for you, for your mobile phone. I say in its next existence will be reborn as a parking meter in Colombo. The lowest form of life for technology. That's only a joke, but nevertheless. So please keep the mobile phones off. And that when you do those vipassana, you should be able to calm the mind down more. I know that many people think that the measure of your insight is how you can convince other people you know the Dhamma. Just with ideas and with philosophies and being able to give Dhamma talk too. That is not a measure of your insight. If you have insight, you should be able to become very peaceful in your meditation. Because insight is the cause for calm. And the calm is the cause for insight. They always go together. So, in the West, I developed my own simile for how samatha vipassana go together. And this was a simile some of you may have heard before, but every time I have a simile, it always changes slightly, every time. So there was a couple, a man and a woman, who lived together. He was called Sam Atta, and she was called Vipassana. And Sam Atta and Vipassana, the girl, the boy and the girl, they were really avid meditators. But they also had two dogs. One dog was called Metta, and the other dog was called Anapana. And one day after lunch, they decided to go for a walk up Samadhi Mountain. They went up there in the afternoon. Sam went up there because it was so peaceful on top of Samadhi Mountain, and he enjoyed stillness and quiet. His wife, Vipassana, she went up there because the view, you could see forever on top of Meditation Mountain. So she took her new camera, a very expensive Canon camera, not one of these iPhone cameras, a really professional camera, to take lots of insight views. And Metta the dog doesn't go up there for any purpose, just for the fun of it. And Anapana, that dog went up Meditation Mountain because the air was so clean and clear there. It made breathing so easy. So, the four of them went up Meditation Mountain, Samadhi Mountain. When they got only halfway, oh, it was already really peaceful and still, even halfway up Samadhi Mountain, that Sam was so happy with his progress. But he also had a pair of eyes and he could see the amazing view. His partner, Vi, oh, she was making all these photographs, clicking here and clicking there, because even halfway up Meditation Mountain, wow, you could see a lot of Dhamma. Metta the dog, she was wagging her tail like dogs do when they're happy, because halfway up Meditation Mountain, there was so much piti sukha. And as for Anapana, oh, Anapana was so peaceful. The air was so beautiful up there. The breath, which was so obvious to see. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, at the top of Meditation Mountain, it was so incredibly still. Nothing moved. Sam enjoyed that incredible peace on top of Samadhi Mountain. But he too had his eyes, and he could see forever the whole of samsara as it was laid out behind, in front of him, easy to see. His wife, Vi, she was making all these incredible insight shots, the sorts of shots that very few people can even take. But she could also appreciate the stillness, because that was there too, on the top of Meditation Mountain. met with a dog. Well, you know what it's like when dogs are really happy. Like that one who chewed my sandals last night must be really happy today. They're dogs. They just go, their tail wags until it's almost falling off, and they go round and round in circles. Meta the dog was so blissed out because the piti sukha on top of Meditation Mountain was indescribable. And as for Anapana, Anapana disappeared. Vanished. Because in a deep meditation, your breath vanishes. And that is my simile for Samatha-vipassana, metta, and anapana, going up Meditation Mountain. They always go together. So, up to a point, and then the dog vanishes, anapana. So, Samatha-vipassana do always go together. So please don't ask, which should I do first, which I should do next. They always happen together. And even I never mentioned on the problems of meditation, I should have mentioned this yesterday, if you do have a problem in meditation, an obstacle, for goodness sake, don't use your willpower. That is like the simile in the West of banging your head against a brick wall. You've got a brick wall in your meditation, you can't find any progress, bang, bang, bang. Your head is much softer than brick. The brick won't break, but your head might. So it's a stupid thing to do. But many people use willpower, endurance, to try and get through, or just dumb patience. Not wise patience, dumb patience. Keep on doing the same thing again and again and again, hoping you can break through. Instead, you use your insight, wisdom power. If you come across a brick wall in your meditation, just stand back and use your wisdom power. You will soon find a little way to the right is a door. A little way to the left is a ladder. You can go through or over that wall instead of just having a narrow view and just banging your head, willpower again and again on that obstacle. So just stand back. I also mention things like metta the dog is a great help. Whenever I come across an obstacle in meditation, well-worn path, how come it's not sort of happening? Often I just, a little bit of loving kindness, metta, just generate metta towards whatever I'm doing. And it's wonderful just how common that solves whatever problem I have in meditation. The kindness, the way I describe it in my books, opening the door of my heart to this moment, expecting nothing, asking for nothing, just opening up. Because that usually pushes me through. A lot of time it's because I'm wanting something. Real loving kindness is not wanting anything. That's why I'm just going off on a tangent here. Sometimes people tell me, oh, please have a safe flight back to Australia, Ajahn Brahm. And I say, no, I'm not going to follow your orders. I'm not going to do what you tell me to do. If I want a safe flight, I will have it. If I don't, it's my choice. The same when you say, may all beings be happy and well. Some beings don't want to be happy and well. So you are ordering them what they should do. So these days, when I do loving kindness meditation, I say, may all beings be happy and well, if they want to. If they don't want to, I'll still be kind to you. It's a different type of metta, which is letting things be with kindness, rather than controlling them with kindness. So letting them be. So for me, when I do that type of metta, obstacles vanish straight away. So that's using some insight. You know, why is there a problem there? What's going on? So insight will always help your samatha. And samatha will always allow more and deeper insights to arise. So they always will go together. So going back to where I finished this morning, the anicca is not just seeing things rise and fall, rise and fall. It's actually seeing things totally vanish, disappear. They were there one moment, and now they're gone. And of course, I got that from the understanding of the use of the Pali word nicca and anicca with the foods which were allowable for bhikkhus. The sangabhata, udesa, bhata, nimantara bhata, all those foodstuffs, offerings which were allowed, and one of them was nicca bhata, a regular supply of food. The dayaka comes once a week on every Tuesday. That's called nicca food, nicca supply of food. Or maybe once a month, or some of them in some viharas or aranyas, they come once a year. Maybe on the anniversary of their birth, the whole family comes once a year and does everything. That is nicca bhata. And if they decide, you know, regularity, always there, same time of year, if they decide to stop that, that's called anicca. What was regular, always there, ceases. So that gave me a far better understanding of the use of this word, and realized that many people do not penetrate anicca simply because they don't really fully understand the meaning of the word, and secondly, they don't have the data of things actually vanishing. So after you come out of a jhana, things have vanished, they've vanished. And you've also noticed they don't just disappear just fast, they fade away. That's viraga. And again, viraga has two meanings. The meaning which most people translate it as is dispassion. And I can't understand that word, because viraga, now the raga finishes a long time before you get close to the deep meditations, but this is another meaning of the word, of a fading away, a disappearance. It was because of that word that, and it was Ajahn Bhamali, who actually chose the title of one of my books, The Art of Disappearing. You know, it's the art of viraga, of things vanishing, little by little, stage by stage, one by one. And the reason why it's important to understand this process of viraga, things disappearing little by little, is made very clear by another simile which I made up, the simile of the emperor. So once upon a time there was an emperor, and no one knew who this emperor was, whether it was a man or a woman, old or young, whether it was Sri Lankan or from China, from Korea, or from Europe, or from Australia. The reason no one knew who this emperor was, because every time the emperor appeared in public, the emperor was covered head to toe with five pieces of clothing. The emperor had boots which not only covered his feet but went right up past his knees to his thighs. The emperor, I shouldn't have said his thighs, to the thighs. The emperor had his trousers which overlapped the top of the boots and came way up the waist. And the emperor had a jacket. The bottom of the jacket overlapped the top of the trousers. The sleeves of the jacket went way to the wrists and up to the neck. And the emperor had gloves which covered the hands and overlapped the end of the sleeves of the jacket. And lastly, the emperor had a helmet which totally covered the head and overlapped the top of the jacket. So these five pieces of clothing, the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves and the helmet, covered every part of the emperor's skin body. So no one ever saw the emperor. No one knew who the emperor truly was. Now that simile, hopefully, if you haven't heard it before, you've worked it out. the emperor is your mind, your citta. And the five pieces of clothing are the sight, hearing, smell, taste, and physical touch. Every time the citta appears, it's covered with those five pieces of clothing. And the only way you can understand what this emperor, the will and the knowing, truly is to take off those five pieces of clothing. To take off the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves and the helmet, to see the true identity of the emperor, your citta. Which is why you have to take away seeing, stop hearing, suppress smell, abandon a taste, and totally relinquish physical touch for you to understand the nature of this emperor called the citta. And that is precisely the job of the jhanas, to free the citta, vimocayang cittang, from the five senses. And then you have an idea of what this citta truly is. And that is based on one of the Buddhist similes of the goldsmith. If you want to find out the nature of true gold, pure gold, you have to get some gold, and you have to take away the impurities first of all, the tin or the zinc or whatever else is in that sample of gold, until it's pure 100% gold, and then you can find out its properties. Now, it's a Buddhist simile of purifying the mind from not just the five hindrances, but also the five senses. Vivicca hi kammehi, vivicca akusala, akusalehi dhammehi. Free from the five senses, free from the five hindrances. That's description of first jhana by the Buddha. Once your mind, the citta, is freed from those things, then, just like a goldsmith, like a chemist, you've got pure gold, now you can understand its true nature. So that is why these things have to disappear, have to fade away. And this is what you have done. You've done the great disappearing act of meditation. You've sat there, and little by little, things have faded away. The past and the future have faded away. The coarse part of your body has faded away. Seeing has faded away. Smell, taste has faded away. All you've got left is usually the seeing and just the experience of the breathing. And that soon fades away too. Slowly. And when it's all faded away, then you've got the citta left. Sometimes I describe the importance of the breathing using a simile of crossing a stream, which is too wide to step across, and there's no bridge, but there is a stepping stone, a rock, a flat rock in the middle of the stream. So you can step onto that rock in the middle of the stream, and from that rock step to the other side. And that rock in the middle of the stream is the breath. So you can't jump over. Some people manage it to do it without the breath, but it's very difficult. So by letting go of the body and all the other five senses, allowing them to fade away, you go to the breath first of all. And you focus on the breath. You allow the mind to settle on the breath. So all you see, all you experience is the breathing. And you can't hear, or it's thousands of miles away when you're hearing. You can't feel the rest of the body, just the breathing. You can't see or smell or taste. All you've got left is that last part of the five senses, the breathing. It's a stepping stone. And from all the five senses to the breath, from the breath over to the citta, the nimitta and the jhanas. It's like a gradual fading away of your five senses. in order to see what happens when the five senses disappear, to understand the jitta, the mind. And you know, this is something which is always, you know, quite a struggle for me. As a popular monk, I meet many scientists, and not only do they reject rebirth or reincarnation, whatever you tell it, they also reject the existence of a mind, a citta. They still manage to believe that the mind is some byproduct of the human brain. And even though the evidence is mounting, it's compelling, they still refuse to understand or accept even the possibility there can be such a thing as a mind, as a citta, independent of the other five senses. That's why I love trying to teach these people some meditation, to get them to have an experience of all those five senses vanishing, fading away, and so they understand, yes, the citta is real, they experience it for themselves, and that will change a lot of how they feel about science. For those of you who may be Westerners, we live in an age of materialism. I don't just mean materialism of worshipping stuff, but it's also a philosophy. Materialist philosophy means all there is stuff, five senses, body, and no mind at all. That is the age in which we live, both philosophically and also socially. And if we can somehow encourage more people to experience the jitta, to get even limiters or jhanas, then it'll be very clear from people's own experience that there's more to life than just stuff. And that will change a lot. But for those of you who have problems with maybe your family or friends, explaining what the mind is, I always love to bring up a simile, which is not in the suttas, because this came from the friend, or rather the daughter of one of my friends who I was at college with. And it's a wonderful story, very logical, but the answer is so Buddhist about what the mind actually is. So, my friend Jeff, who I still see, a common friend with this Professor Bernard Carr, who I mentioned earlier, who is a close friend of Stephen Hawking's. My friend Jeff wrote a letter to me in my first years as a monk in Thailand, telling me about something which happened to his daughter, who was called Pascal, because he married a Swiss girl. And Pascal's first year in school, grade one. And the teacher asked every child in the school the question, what is the biggest thing in the world? That was the exercise for 5-6-year-old children. So one kid put their hand up. This actually happened. My daddy is the biggest thing in the world. This is a child, and to them the daddy was huge. And someone said, no, 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 an elephant is much bigger than her daddy, because they'd just been to the zoo a few days earlier. No, 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 a mountain is much bigger than an elephant. It's getting better each time. But then Pascal, the daughter of one of my best friends in college, put up her hand and said, no, miss, the eye is the biggest thing in the world. And no one, not even the teacher, understood what she meant. So, explain. Well, miss, said this 5-year-old genius, who, by the way, later graduated with a PhD from Oxford in biochemistry or something. She was brilliant at 5, let alone when she was 21. And she said, my eye is the biggest thing in the world because my eye can see her daddy, my eye can see an elephant, my eye can see a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. Now that is insight. Seeing things from a different angle, a different perception, which gives you a much broader understanding of truth. And it was so remarkable, he sent that experience in a letter to me. And I wrote back and said, I'll give your daughter 9 out of 10, but not 10 out of 10. Close, but not quite enough. It is true that your mind, anything can fit in. Sorry, I've already gone too far. That your eye, many things can fit into your eye. But your mind is something even larger. Because the human mind can see everything the eye can see. And it can imagine things you'll never ever see in this real world. Your mind can hear sounds, real and imaginary, tastes, smells, touches, and it's also got its own area, specific to the mind. Everything which can ever be experienced or known, all of that can fit into your mind. Therefore, the mind, the citta, is the biggest thing. And you may have noticed, I never said the biggest thing in the world. The world can fit into your mind. You can know the world. Everything you can ever know fits into your mind. Therefore, the world fits in there too. The biggest thing is the mind. Dhammapada, verse 1. So, when you understand the mind like that, it makes philosophy a lot more different. You get even more interesting insights. You understand the nature of this mind. And they can only verify that when things start to fade away. But, again, I thought I would give that 10 out of 10, but really, no, it's only 10 out of 11. There's further stuff to experience yet. Because many people stop there, and they think experiencing that mind is the end of the spiritual path. Union with God, united with Brahma, everything, all come to one magnificent point. But when you get to the deeper meditations, first jhanas sometimes, you should be able to see what happens next with the Buddha's teachings, but it really helps to get another jhana, a second jhana, to realize the first is not the end. Many people, if they have not enough teachings of the Dhamma, may experience the first jhana and confuse that to being fully enlightened. It has many of the attributes of enlightenment. You can't find any perception of a self in there, no me. Bliss, peaceful, still. So many people confuse even the first jhana for enlightenment, the end of the path. Samadhi in Hinduism. It's often regarded, when you reach samadhi, that's it, that's the end. But, if you get a second jhana, then you realize first jhana is not the end. There's more. And, after second jhana, soon you find out there's more. The mind now starts to fade away. Viraga is not just confined to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching, not to the five senses and its objects, also to the sixth sense and its objects as well. They too fade away. Which is the scariest thing you'll ever come across. When people meditate, and again I should have mentioned this yesterday when I was talking about the obstacles, fear is one of the obstacles which often comes up in the deeper stages of meditation and stops you progressing. Why is it fear? It's because something you're really attached to is being taken away. And by attached to, I mean deeply attached to, something which defines the sense of who you are. Your personal identity is being destroyed. And for many people, that's the most difficult thing to let go of. Not their material possessions, but their mind possessions. Their sense of self and identity and being. That starts to vanish. When your senses vanish, your five senses, you realize there's nothing to do with this body. You are not a man. You are not a woman. You are not gay. That's why gays are allowed to ordain, because that's just the shell. That's not who they really are. You are not Sri Lankan. Just your passport says that. I like to get passports for arahats, enlightened beings. And when they say, what is your name? They say, just Arya. When you have your photograph, it's just a blank spot there. No identity. You've given up identity. When they say what country you belong to, say nowhere. I am nowhere, nothing, nobody. In Australia. It's amazing where you see the most profound teachings in the most unexpected places. And this was on a t-shirt. A t-shirt worn by a young Australian man. And the t-shirt was teaching about anatta. Really profound teaching. On the top it said, first thing, I am a nobody. The second line was, nobody is perfect. And the third line, therefore, I am perfect. I am a nobody. Nobody is perfect. Therefore, I am perfect. So if you want perfection, be a nobody. Anatta, because nobody is perfect. Oh, like have great fun with talking about anatta to your friends in other religions. A year ago, I was about to go to Malaysia to teach a retreat. And a Christian friend, you know, I always like having discussions, good discussions with people from other religions. But people from other religions sometimes try to get a bit cheeky with you and try to convert you. That's what they do. And they can't help themselves. It's like dogs go woof woof. Some Christians go, believe in Jesus. They can't do anything else. That's just like a woof woof, meow meow, believe in Jesus. That's just who they are. So anyway, usually you just tolerate that. But this time he went one step further. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, you have to admit that nothing is greater than God. I said, yeah, I admit it. Absolutely true. I totally concur with you. Nothing, anatta, is much greater and higher than any being in this universe, especially God. Yes, nothing, anatta, is greater than God. He said, that's not what I meant, Ajahn Brahm. So that's what I meant. That's the greatest, nothing. That's why Ajahn Chah said, why? There's nothing. So anyway, when things fade away, that's when you find everything fades away. And the result of fading away, it fades away slowly. Not suddenly, it's there one moment and totally gone. It vanishes. Like the best simile, many of you Sri Lankans, I'm not sure when you were at school, you read the books by Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland. I don't know if that was in your curriculum. No, okay. But this was a famous English author who was actually a professor of mathematics at Oxford. And he wrote these books. Apparently they made movies of Alice in Wonderland now. But he was very strange and weird, this Lewis Carroll. And he wrote the passage of the heroine Alice coming across a Cheshire cat. A Cheshire cat is a species of cat which it just always looks like it's smiling. That's just its nature. It's not really smiling or happy, just the way its mouth is formed. It looks like it is smiling. And this Cheshire cat appeared on a branch of a tree and suddenly vanished. And then appeared again and suddenly vanished. This was in a novel. And Alice said, "I wish you would stop vanishing so fast. It makes me quite dizzy." And so the Cheshire Cat, out of compassion, said, "Okay, I will vanish slowly." And the Cheshire Cat vanished. First its tail vanished, then its paws and legs vanished, then its body vanished, only its head was there. Then its ears vanished, then its whiskers vanished, then its whole head vanished, leaving only the smile. And Alice said, "This is most curious. I've often seen a cat without a smile, but I've never seen a smile without a cat." It was a very beautiful use of English, and I don't know whether you can translate into Sinhala or not. But when I read that, or rather remembered that, I thought, wow, what a great simile that is for Wiraga. Things vanish. First of all, your whole body vanishes when you get into jhana, leaving only a smile, piti sukha, bliss of all the different jhanas, without a body. To me, that is a smile without a body, the smile without the cat. But then, the smile vanishes too. Your jitta starts to fade away, slowly. First jhana, to second jhana, to third jhana, to fourth jhana. It is the greatest disappearing act in samsara. That you, the one who knows, or rather, you think you're the one who knows. The one who does disappears first of all. Your will vanishes, allowing stillness to solidify. And when it's still, it vanishes. First of all, the body and the five senses vanish. Then the last movement of the mind, the vitaka vichara, vanishes. Then the piti vanishes. Then the sukha vanishes. To real stillness. And then, because the jitta is totally still, that's all vedana vanishing. And then, except the equanimity. And then, because it's so still, the mind, the jitta, has to vanish. Stillness is the cause for disappearance. It vanishes. Little by little, stage by stage, the arupas, the great disappearing act of the jitta. That's why it says that fourth jhana is the peak of mindfulness. The purity, perfection of mindfulness. Because after that, in the arupas, the mindfulness vanishes. It disappears. Slowly disappearing until cessation. Nirodha. So, this is how we contemplate. From experience which not many people have. How? To know anicca. Once is anicca, things vanishing, to see they vanish slowly, because of stillness, and to see they cease, totally gone. That is how we practice insight. We don't think about it, we don't contemplate it, we experience it. And that is, somebody asked me that in the questions, kaya patisangvedi. It's an idiom. It doesn't mean you feel it with your physical body. You experience it. You know it. You don't think about it, you don't believe it, you don't hear it and say, "Oh, that makes sense to me." It's right in front of you. You see it, you know it, you feel it, you smell it. It's experience, direct experience. And then afterwards, Patinissaka. What does Patinissaka mean? You let it all go. When you realize that nothing belongs to you, of course, you let it go. I don't know why some people get upset when their shoes get bitten by a dog and destroyed. They weren't my shoes anyway. They weren't even my feet. So what am I worried about? Someone get me some more shoes if necessary. And anyway, I really think it's a plan. That was a plan by Venerable Metta Vihari, because it is one of the rules of aviation. You cannot go on an aircraft without shoes. They won't let you on. So I think he arranged that last night. So we didn't have any shoes, so I can't go back to Australia, so I have to stay in Sri Lanka for another couple of weeks. Was that true? No, he wouldn't do such things. But when people scold you, you stupid monk, that's not what the Buddha said, then who are they scolding? It's not me. I've been looking inside me for a long time. I can't find anything. So it's amazing. You can find somebody to blame and scold. You can see something I can't see. Who is there to scold? Who is there to praise? As I said the other day, if you receive any praise and blame, for goodness sake, imagine you're just like the lotus. They can pee on you. They can put Chanel number 5 on you. It just all just flows off. I did say that simile, did I? Not here. Okay, I think maybe in interviews. Once here, I did, yeah. Okay, you must have been in jhana. Yeah. So, yeah, that's how you deal, because you don't keep anything. There's nothing to keep it. Or an even better simile, when you understand how to let go, Patinissaka, through seeing anicca, seeing viraga, seeing nirodha. You know that sometimes people think, especially in the West, people come to meditate, they come to Buddhism, trying to improve themselves, trying to be better human beings. Many lay people especially, they learn meditation so they can work harder at work and make more progress without getting stressed or without getting sick. Many people come to learn meditation to overcome things like cancers. Many people just, they try to learn meditation so they can become more peaceful human beings, wiser and more compassionate. You're trying to improve yourself, to lessen suffering and increase happiness in your life. And so realizing that that was a waste of time, there's no one in here to improve. That I developed a simile. And this was many, many years ago, before Google, the driverless bus simile. And I think you can get some of the old talks where I started talking about driverless bus. And it must have been psychic powers predicting the future, because now there are driverless buses. Google cars, I've seen them. So this was a simile of the driverless bus. Your life is like a bus journey, and you're sitting in your seat, and sometimes your life goes through some very happy, wonderful times. You're really enjoying yourself, and you tell your bus driver, the will, slow down, even stop. I want to enjoy this pleasant, enjoyable, fruitful moment. This retreat is wonderful. I'm getting so much. This time is flowing too fast. Slow down and enjoy. And what does your bus driver do? He pushes his foot down on the accelerator and you speed out of the happy moments of your life. And other times, you are having a lot of suffering. A lot of pain and frustration. And you ask your will, come on, get out of here. Sometimes you're really sick. and you can't go to sleep at night, and the night goes on for so long. 1 hour is such a long time at night when you're sick. Why can't it speed up? So you tell your bus driver, come on, this is a terrible place we're going through. Speed up. And what does your bus driver do? Slows down. Suffering lasts much longer than it should. Happiness, it passes too quickly. So many people come to Buddhism so they can get more wisdom and compassion, not for the purpose of ending samsara, but for the purpose of controlling samsara, so they can have more happiness and less suffering. So they can slow down in the happy moments of life and speed out of the difficult moments in life using wise teachings like my two bad bricks in the wall. Like open the door of your hearts. All those teachings which, you know, are pretty meaningless actually. But, you know, they help get people involved in Buddhism. And they raise a lot of funds for my temples. But, the real teaching is this. That after a while, when it doesn't work, when you try everything to lessen suffering and increase happiness, you try meditation for that sometimes. So what happens when you get frustrated? You feel it's this will, it's its fault. My will is so stupid. Surely by now, when I need to get into jhana, will, come on, get into jhana. And sometimes it doesn't do it. Stupid will. Why not? Come on, be wise. Go and see some teaching, get all the tricks. So you can have fun whenever you want. And when you're sick, have suffering so you can get out of suffering whenever you want. Find all the tricks. So, you want to find that bus driver and teach it the Dhamma for the purpose of increasing happiness and lessening suffering. That's the reason you do this. But you have to find the will, the bus driver, to teach it how to drive a bus. And that's what happens in meditation. You get to the bus driver's seat in second jhana. This is simile. The bus driver's seat, the will. The one who decides what you're doing, how you do it, how quick, how fast, how slow. And when you find the bus driver's seat in your jitta, that is where you get an experience you never expected. The bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. You are not in control of your meditation. You think that you've made all the wrong decisions, that's why you haven't got jhana yet. You think you can listen to a monk like me and train your will so jhana's become easy. That is gomayang. Because what happens when you find that bus driver's seat? You find it's empty. No one is driving your bus, your meditation. So what happens? You go back to where you're sitting in the back of the bus. You stop complaining. There's no one to complain to. No more craving or wanting. It's a waste of time. There's no one who will listen to me when I say, I want this, I want that, I crave this, I crave that. Total waste of energy. There's no bus driver you can order to do anything. And also you stop getting aversion. No one's fault. You can't blame the bus driver anymore. He stops in the suffering. Not bus driver, no one's fault. It's cause and effect. Karma, that's all it is. So you stop all wanting and all dislike. Peace at last. If you really understand that simile, not just theoretically, but from experience, that's anagami. No more craving. No more ill will. There's no one really to blame. There's no one to actually to ask any favors from. No need to crave or desire. Waste of time. It's like asking a bus driver. It's asking the Google car. Go faster. Go slower. It's for like me traveling in an aircraft. Say, we're going over Indonesia. No, from Singapore back to Perth. Can you please go down? I want to see Borobudur from the sky. Pilot, can you please just do that for me? Would the pilot on Singapore Airlines do what I ask? It's a total waste of time. They'd probably arrest me when I get to Perth for interfering with the aircraft as a terrorist or something. I can't do anything. In fact, all I ever do when I go traveling, I just sit down and do absolutely nothing. You know what happens when you travel on an aircraft? I travel so much. You're just sitting there, doing nothing. And this flight attendant comes up and said, "Ajahn Brahm, would you like some lunch? Would you like a cup of tea?" I never press the button to call the flight attendant. They come to me. And that's exactly what happens in the path of the Eightfold Path. You're just sitting there on what I call these days Buddha air. And you're just sitting there. And then this wonderful flight attendant comes up and said, "Sir, would you like first jhana?" I said, "Okay." It comes to you. You never go chasing it. Later on in the flight, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Oh yeah, I'll take that. And sometimes they come up, special offerings. It's Chinese New Year today. Singapore Airlines, they give special gifts on Chinese New Year. So today, because it's Chinese New Year, we're giving psychic powers. Would you like some levitation, sir, or some reading people's minds? Or it just comes to you. Don't go seeking it. And then just before they land, they say, "Sir, because you're a frequent flyer, streamlining." "Oh yeah, I'll have that." And then non-returning. So, well, I can't say I want that because I disappeared the last time you gave me a gift. And so on. But all these things come to you. You don't go chasing them. That's what happens when you realize the bus driver's seat is empty. All your will is a total, not just a waste of time, but a hindrance to your enlightenment. So for goodness sake, in the next meditation, because it's now 4 o'clock, just sit down there and shut up. Stop doing stuff. Stop wanting stuff. Stop thinking. Just sit there. Stop aspiring. Stop. Just like the Buddha said to Angulimala, stop. Angulimala understood. It wasn't just stop chasing. It wasn't just stop killing and breaking your precepts. It was much more profound than that. Stop. And then you're on Buddha air, and all these things will be delivered. Come to you, not you go to them. That is insight. And that is what happens. The 13, 14, 15, 16 stages of Anapana. You just give up everything. You give up complaining. You give up wanting. Pati nisaga. It's not you give up your stuff like your sandals or your robe. It's not material stuff. That's easy to give up. It's giving up the stuff in here. The controlling. The wanting. The knowing. Can you give that up? Can you give up bhava dhanha? The craving to exist. To know. That happens. You can't give that up. It just fades away and ceases. You're on Buddha air and there's no destination. Just like MH370. You disappear and no one can find you. Thank you for listening. MH370 was the aircraft, Malaysian aircraft, which disappeared somewhere. No one's ever been able to find it, where it's gone. Must have entered Nirvana with everybody on board. Okay, thank you for listening. We now have interviews. It's quit. Okay, but have to finish the interviews by 5:30, and I know there's a lot of people always on the list, always wanting. So if you are on the interview, get there early. Please keep your questions concise so that you can give space for the next person to come, so many people can enjoy the interviews. It's not just time to hang out with Ajahn Brahm. No, you keep it sort of, you know, meaningful. Okay, thanks very much.